Funding for Think comes from SMU Continuing and Professional Education.
You're listening to Think on KERA 90.1. I'm Chris Boyd. How did the light bulb change the world? Safe, consistent artificial illumination is so common today that we hardly recognize the ways in which it has shaped our lives and livelihoods for well over a century. Some people still bristle at the fact that Thomas Edison gets all the credit for what was inarguably a shared process of research and development, both within and far beyond Edison's Menlo Park labs. But as my guest today will explain, Thomas Edison was uniquely positioned to apply the best of other scientists' conclusions to a practical need and to see that his invention was made available to a world eager for the power to remake the long hours of darkness that had shaped human society for millennia. Ernest Freeburg is Distinguished Professor of Humanities in the History Department at the University of Tennessee. His new book is called The Age of Edison, Electric Light and the Invention of Modern America. Ernest, welcome to Think.
Thank you very much, Chris. It's great to be here.
You remind us here that people in the 19th century were the first to live in an era of what you call perpetual invention. Can you talk about how exciting that must have been?
People talked about this all the time. You know, we think back on the late 19th century as a time of enormous social and economic problems, a sharp division between the rich and the poor, conflicts between labor and management, urban crowding and pollution and immigration. But if you look back at the sources, people back then, many of them felt that they were living in the most exciting time in human history. And a lot of that had to do with the fact that they were constantly having arrive in their lives these transformative technologies, the telegraph and the telephone and the gasoline engine, the steam engine. And I would suggest electric light is not only one of those important ones, but in some ways the most important.
Until the incandescent bulb was perfected and the country electrified, talk about what lives were like at night when it got dark.
Well, it depends on where you lived. In rural areas, kerosene emerged in the 1850s, and that was a great new technology. People clearly in the 19th century were hungry for light. That's why Edison and his rival inventors knew that there was a great market. Think about the enormous lengths that we went to in order to harvest sperm whales around the globe. Again, a hunger for light that was replaced in cities by gaslight, which really had started the idea of distributing across a large urban area through underground networks an energy source that would provide light for people. And gas was terrible. A horrible technology in many ways, but people were very happy to have it, very excited to have it.
What made it so inferior as compared with electric light?
Well, it was an open flame in your house, multiple open flames, so there were hazards in terms of fire, but it also spewed noxious fumes into the air. It sucked the oxygen out of the air. It overheated rooms. You go back and look at the sources, and it made possible a lively nightlife, for example, but people would go out to the theater, and they would be very impressed by the beautiful gas lights, but they would come home reeling with a gas light hangover. Hmm. It just caused terrible problems, health problems. It also, the acids that it threw into the room were very destructive of paint and leather and fabric. So that people who were wealthy enough to have gaslight also had to be wealthy enough to redecorate their houses every couple years in order to fix the problems caused by having gaslight in their homes.
And when you say wealthy enough, there was a significant cost attached to this technology.
Sure, there was. I mean, it started out, like all of these technologies, it started out as something that was serving the wealthier neighborhoods first. Gaslight became increasingly a middle-class comfort so that when Edison emerged to rival the gas companies, he was taking on really some of the most heavily capitalized, most politically influential corporations in the country at that point. The gas companies in every city were a powerful force to be reckoned with.
So Edison famously introduced his bulb in 1879, but way back in the early part of the century, Sir Humphrey Davy had at least proved that incandescent light was possible. Can you tell us about him?
Yeah. He was not interested in this as a commercial application, but rather he was one of the pioneers in electrochemistry. So he was very interested in electricity and what it could teach people about the natural world. But along the way, he demonstrated in 1810, I believe it was, the principle of both arc lighting, which became very important, one form of lighting, and then also the idea of incandescence. But to do that, he had to rely on chemical batteries that were enormously expensive to create, and this was really more of a curiosity at that point than it was a viable machine that one might market. But it set off decades of people trying to develop a viable electric light long before, you know, really essentially 60 years of experimenting. And if you go back and look at the old newspapers, about every few months somebody is announcing that they've figured it out and they're about to launch the electric light and it's going to change things forever. And it's really not until the late 1870s that race comes to a head.
So why did it take such a long time? Because as you mentioned, everybody sort of thought it was just around the corner for decades.
Well, there were several reasons. One was the technology was not there until the dynamo. Faraday later developed the dynamo, and that made possible creating electricity using the magnetic field instead of a chemical reaction. And that created for the first time the possibility of a less expensive, more viable, steady form of electricity. So that was an important step. In terms of the incandescent bulb, one of the missing things was that everybody recognized that you needed to create a vacuum in the bulb, and it was not really possible to make a very effective vacuum until much later. So people knew the formula, but they did not have the tools in order to actually create something that would manage to glow, to get up to that intense temperature without burning up.
Can you help us understand the difference between, basic difference between an arc light and the technology and an incandescent light?
Yeah, the arc light, it came first, and many people were most drawn to that because it produces just an enormous quantity of light. Arc light is created when you send a strong current into a lamp that essentially has two carbon rods or wicks held very close together, and the electricity goes down one of the carbon wicks and jumps the gap over to the other. And so the lamp has to hold those two wicks just close together enough so that the electricity, the circuit's not broken and the electricity can jump. And that produces a light that I think is similar to the what we think of as arc welding light now, mm-hmm. A light that's so intense that it really is not suitable for indoors, but it was the first way that electricity could challenge gas out in the streets for control of city streets and city parks.
And yeah, in fact, people were setting up, like putting them on tall poles, right, and trying to light up large areas with these things?
That's right. I mean, they were so powerful that, you know, people had to wear umbrellas, use umbrellas to sort of protect themselves from the light. It was so intense. And people had the idea, because it was still pretty expensive, you had to replace those carbons regularly, and this was, of course, a new technology, so it was not cheap. So when towns first got into the business of trying to do this, a number of them tried to solve the street lighting problem by creating just a single giant tower in the center of town and put a big light up there, sort of like an artificial moon floating up there. Turned out to be one of those things that seemed like a good idea at the time and did not work out for various reasons. It cast a very strange light that mm-hmm. could be very intense in some places, but then there would be deep shadows whenever there were trees or buildings blocking the way. So they tried to compensate for that by making multiple towers. I mean, this would work best in a town that was very flat and didn't have tall buildings. So out in the plains, sometimes people were happy with this. But basically, it became problematic. People were very proud of this, excited to have this one of these giant towers. But within a few years, they realized this was a wrong turn, and these towers started to either be taken down or fall down. Hmm. They weren't they weren't so good at putting up the towers, so many of them fell in high winds.
Yeah, we'll definitely talk in a little bit this hour about the safety concerns with the early electrification of the country and all the technologies involved. I want to talk for a minute, though, about when Edison turned his attention to the problem of creating a functional, marketable light bulb. One thing he had working for him was this great reputation for success.
That's right. He was, you know, he had his first big breakthrough was in some telegraph patents that gave him a good chunk of money to go into the invention business more seriously. And then he produced the phonograph, which earned him the reputation as the Wizard of Menlo Park. People weren't quite sure what the phonograph was good for initially, since they didn't use it for music originally. But they knew that it was an amazing invention. And so Edison had a tremendous reputation. And when he announced, and this was, as you have suggested, Chris, a crowded field of people who were trying to invent the light bulb. But when Edison said he's going to enter the race and try his hand at this, stock markets tumbled for gas stocks around the world because people were just convinced if Edison says he's going to do it, it'll happen.
But it took even him longer than he had expected. Talk about how he courted investors and the kind of commitment he wanted from them.
He, you know, it's often said that what Edison's biggest invention really was a style of invention, and this really was the thing that gave him an edge over his rivals, was that he understood earlier than others did the value of teamwork, and that involved a lot of money to allow this group of people that he assembled to work without, you know, with temporary relief from the pressures of the marketplace. So he knew he was going after the electric light, but he knew it would take a lot of resources and a lot of people. And Edison, although he liked to pride himself on being largely self-taught and you know, said that college was a waste of time, he also knew enough to hire university-trained mathematicians and people with backgrounds in sciences that he didn't have. And so he channeled his energy and his ideas by working with this team in a collaborative effort. The capitalists who were backing him, people like J.P. Morgan and the Vanderbilts, were, you know, recognized the fact that there was a gold mine to be made for the person who could take on the gas companies. But they quickly grew frustrated with how much money this was costing and how slow this was going. Edison promised initially that he had solved the problem in a way that turned out to be completely wrong and got everybody's hopes up, and then was revealed to be a fraud. And people started to say, well, maybe this guy, you know, maybe he was a wizard with the phonograph, but he may have promised something he really can't deliver at this point. And that made the capitalists understandably nervous.
What was it like to work for Thomas Edison?
Most people who worked with him had enormous respect for him. And even people who had, you know, higher level math and science skills than he did, really, with very few exceptions, always gave him the credit for being the person who had a kind of intuitive insight into the nature of some problems. You know, in some sense, his lack of education helped him to think a little bit differently and to see solutions to problems and maybe to, you know, that is a long and endless debate, really, about whether Edison was well-served by his idea that he would try a zillion things and, you know, one would finally work. That kind of approach, rather than thinking through problems in a more deductive way. But people loved, you know, they would work round the clock, 24 hours a day, with long naps in the afternoon and breaks for pie and cigars, and it was really quite a team.
Ernest Freeburg is my guest. He's Distinguished Professor of Humanities in the History Department at the University of Tennessee and author of the new book, The Age of Edison, Electric Light and the Invention of Modern America. Join the conversation by calling in to 1-800-933-5372 or send email to think@kera.org.
Funding for Think comes from SMU Continuing and Professional Education. You can give your kids or grandkids a creative and educational experience this summer at SMU in Plano. smu.edu/CAPE Summer Youth.
You're listening to Think on KERA 90.1. I'm Chris Boyd. We're speaking this hour with Ernest Freeburg, who is Distinguished Professor of Humanities in the History Department at the University of Tennessee. His new book is called The Age of Edison, Electric Light and the Invention of Modern America. Join the conversation at 1-800-933-5372 or send email to think@kera.org. So, Ernest, what was the big breakthrough for Edison and his team?
It really was a combination of things. When Edison first unveiled his light bulb, there's the famous moment at Menlo Park where he invited the public to take a look. But the real big unveiling was later that year in 1880 when he brought his light bulb to Paris to the great International Electrical Exposition. But Edison was there with five other inventors who also had a working incandescent light bulb to show. So he really, and these people often had patents, important patents, ahead of Edison. They've very often suggested that Edison had stolen his ideas, or at least that he was certainly not original in putting together the pieces of a working light bulb, the vacuum, the carbon filament, and so forth. But what Edison really brought to the table in Paris was not just a light bulb, but an entire elaborated system linked back to a central power station. While others had figured out how to develop enough light to light a house or a ship or some small location like that, Edison was thinking in terms of the big picture of how to go into the streets and take on gaslight. So he had to not just invent a working light bulb, but also a much more efficient dynamo to deliver the power. He's the one who worked out with his team the wires and the networks and making sure that functioned effectively, some regulators on that. And he also had to figure out how to do the meter so that he could charge customers a fair amount for the amount of current that they were using. Edison figured out all these things sort of and was effective at thinking in terms of a system rather than any one individual problem. And that really was the edge that got him into the business ahead of everybody else and led to his reputation, not as the inventor of the light bulb, but as the inventor of a system that made electric light commercially viable.
Now, why was he so convinced that direct current was a better solution than alternating current?
Well, I think partly it has to do with the fact that it was safer. It was a lower voltage, or at least was perceived to be safer. The AC power that was used for the arc lights, for example, at that point was much less well known and operated at a higher voltage that made it more dangerous, especially because there was not much in the way of insulation. So Edison bet on DC.
Mm-hmm. Now, the early days of wiring cities and then ultimately the country, it sounds like kind of a mess.
Absolutely. There was, it didn't take that much to go into the lighting business. You could subcontract, a license from Edison or from any number of, there were 8 or 9 or 10 rival electric companies in the business at that point, and they would sell you a dynamo and a string of lights, and you could go into the lighting business. And cities and towns were eager to have electric light. They wanted to be seen as keeping up with the times. And so they would issue franchises to these people, and they just proceeded to throw these electric light wires all over the place without any guidelines about where the poles should go or whether or not where poles were allowed. They would throw wires right over people's houses or tack them to trees, in some cases tack them right to the sides of people's houses without their permission. And it was just chaos. And these were high-powered wires at a time when they hadn't figured out insulation. The closest thing to insulation they had was cloth and paint. So it became immediately very, very dangerous. Edison, buried his wires, and they were a little, they were less dangerous, not safe, but less dangerous. But the arc light wires especially were immediately a real threat to health and safety.
How did they train up a whole country's worth of electricians so quickly?
It was a lot of very painful trial and error. There was no Edison himself had to train his own employees. There were no schools. There were a lot of people interested in electricity, especially coming out of the telegraph industry, which really was the first great electrical industry in the country. So there were a lot of young men who were interested in the nature of electricity. Edison himself began in the telegraph industry and learned what he knew about electricity from tinkering and then experimenting in that field. So they came out of that field, but they were, you know, they were pretty reckless. It was sort of a, you know, you were sort of had to be something of a modern day cowboy to be up there on the poles with these dangerous wires, and people, you know, were horrified as these people started to die in pretty large numbers up there.
1-800-933-5372 is our telephone number. We're speaking to Ernest Freeberg about his book, The Age of Edison. Let's go on the phone now and speak with Stephen in Dallas. Hi, Stephen.
Hey. I just want to relate something. As a child, taking piano lessons from a character that he had an original Edison light bulb in his in his kitchen. And every time, on a weekly basis, I demanded that we go in there and check it out. Yeah. And it was quite a an enlightening experience. He was a rather he was very very interesting character. A lot of first editions, and his uncle was given an original Raphael.
Well, the light bulb story sounds interesting. Would it have looked and functioned very differently, Ernest, than the ones we were familiar with growing up?
Yes. The original bulbs used a carbon filament. Edison experimented with different ideas for that. First it was charred cardboard, and then it was a strip of bamboo, and later it was a cellulose paste. Mm-hmm. But it looked similar. The lighting was lower than what happened in the early 20th century. German scientists and then General Electric developed the metallic filament that we're familiar with, which was a much brighter, more efficient bulb. Those old lights, I was interested to find out that if you signed up with the Edison Company or a similar company for electric light, they would provide the light bulbs, and they would, in fact, send the electrician around to your house to replace the light bulbs periodically. And often that's because the light bulbs didn't break, but they just got dimmer and dimmer. You know, we're used to the idea that a light bulb is going full force, and then it's not going at all.
Right.
And apparently, instead, with the early bulbs, they would just go and go and go. But they would the efficiency would drop. They would often fill up with the sort of carbon soot, and at a certain point, a customer would start to feel like he or she was paying for something that wasn't that satisfactory, and the electric company would have to come around and change the light bulbs.
So you did a great job earlier describing why, you know, obviously people were so hungry to have these lights on. And it changed not only life at home, which we can talk about, but it changed the nature of business and the what people expected to do out at night.
Sure. Yeah. I mean, the most obvious place it was immediately applied was in transportation. Up until that point, and this is the beginnings, of course, in the 19th century, there's a massive industrial revolution and expansion of the market economy, you know, lots and lots of goods to be sold across the globe, the power of you know, train travel to create a national market. But those trains didn't travel at night, or they traveled very slowly, because if you just had an oil lamp at the front of your locomotive, there's no way you saw what was coming ahead. And the signal systems were also much less reliable. So people worked right away to try to figure out how to put one of these powerful arc lights on the front of a locomotive to allow for train travel through the night at full speed. Hmm. Same thing happened with shipping. You know, people, very, very crowded seas at this point, and they started to have terrible problems with shipwrecks. And so these powerful electric lights were used right away in lighthouses, and also adapted to ships to make ship travel much safer.
And, you know, it's funny. I had never thought before reading your book about what it must have been like to have surgery before there was really strong artificial electric light in the room. But this was a game changer.
It was. You go back and look at the older medical journals, and they had to, obviously you can't hold an open flame inside a body or down into somebody's ear or throat to see what's going on. And so they had to develop these elaborate systems of mirrors to sort of reflect, bounce the light from a flame down into the spot. So surgeons were very excited about electric light. And, I mean, this is part of what I was actually most interested in the book, was to sort of to follow what happens to the light bulb once it leaves Edison's laboratory and goes out into the world. And it was really hard to find any profession, any walk of life where people couldn't see some great advantages to adapting the light bulb to their own particular uses. And surgery was all sorts of very specialized instruments to allow for any given kind of operation. They figured out a way to add a light bulb to the tool.
1-800-933-5372 is our telephone number. You can also send email to think@kera.org. We have Carol on the line now in Flower Mound. Hi, Carol.
Good morning.
Hi, go right ahead, please.
Wanted to ask if anybody's ever looked at the effect of electric lights on the circadian rhythms of the body, where we have this day-night cycling that's normal, and then we have interrupted it with electric lights and the incidence of depression and sleep deprivation because we can stay up too late, and even the earlier sexual maturation of our children may be related to melatonin and electric lights.
Caroline, you'll be interested to find out you are not the first person to worry about this.
I was looking for that, of course, because I think we know a lot about this now and are increasingly aware of this. Clearly, right from the start, and this even in the age of gaslight, people started to complain about feeling increasingly exhausted. The culture was accelerating in a particular way, and nobody was sleeping well. And there is an enormous explosion of concern in the late 19th century with nervous disabilities, what they often called neurasthenia. And there was a lot of interest in developing spas and therapies to try to help people who were complaining all the time of things that looked to us a little, it's a little hard to go back and figure out what exactly was ailing them, but one plausible explanation is that they weren't sleeping well. So I don't think they understood it in quite that same way. Many people felt, as we do when we're exposed to electric light, felt energized rather than exhausted. People felt like, wow, we live in a culture now where we're getting so much more done than we ever were, and we're not only working a full long day, but we're staying up all night, having this great nightlife. People felt energized when, in fact, of course, there's plenty of evidence to suggest that this has a very disruptive to our sleep patterns and our health.
And, of course, people now could work around the clock in ways that were not even imaginable before electric light.
Yeah. I mean, the capitalists who had invested in these very expensive machines recognized that this was a tremendous tool for getting two or three times as much work out of their machines if they can get workers to show up through the night shift to keep these things going. Workers pushed back against this. They loved to have the electric light in many professions. If you were working in an office, if you were doing some sort of fine work, like working with fabrics or a printer or so forth, the electric light was a wonderful tool and much better. People working in the post office no longer had to wear spectacles often to read in the murky gaslight. They loved the electric light, but they didn't want to work the longer day. So there was a struggle here, just at a time when workers were organizing to have a shorter work day in the late 19th century, the 10-hour day movement and the 8-hour day movement. There was a pushback in the other direction to keep work going. And workers who could afford to do it, workers who had some bargaining position, they didn't stop the night shift, but they managed to demand more pay for the night shift. And that was sort of the compromise that worked for them. It didn't work for child labor. A lot of children working in mines and textile mills and so forth, and working late into night. And that became a central cause of the labor reformers in the late 19th and early 20th century, was to stop the use of children, not just in labor in general, but specifically having them work the midnight shift, which they often did.
Because they had the least say, essentially, in the conditions under which they worked.
That's right.
On a happier note or a lighter note, for people who were off in the evenings, the draw of these brightly lighted big cities, particularly those with, you know, downtown areas, it must have been really exciting to be the first generation to experience that.
Absolutely. They just loved it, as we do now. Mm-hmm. I mean, there's something about bright, swirling light that we're just drawn to. It makes us feel good. And the people who figured out how to market that are, you know, it's fascinating to go back. P.T. Barnum was very aware of this, used this very quickly. The pioneers of Coney Island sort of figured out things about, you know, that people would really, you know, they loved the rides and they loved the food, but what they really loved at Coney Island was to go at night and to be exposed, saturated to millions of light bulbs. You know, it just creates a sort of sense of euphoria in us that, you know, we recognize anytime we're in a downtown area, we're drawn to that light and that excitement.
Yeah, it's funny. We take the expression bright lights, big city sort of for granted today. But there was a time when those things weren't necessarily associated with one another.
That's right. And if you were in a rural area at that point, you increasingly felt like you were missing something great. Hmm. You know, you knew by reading magazines and newspapers that somewhere out there, there was night baseball and the theater was, you know, going, and restaurants open all hours of the night, and this thing called Times Square. And, you know, there was an interesting dividing line at a time when the country was really moving from a predominantly rural to an urban culture. Electric light really marked the boundary where urban began, and the rural was sort of left staring from a distance.
We'll talk about that in a couple of minutes. My guest is Ernest Freeburg. He's Distinguished Professor of Humanities in the History Department at the University of Tennessee, and he's author of the new book, The Age of Edison, Electric Light and the Invention of Modern America. Join the conversation at 1-800-933-5372 or send email to think@kera.org.
Funding for Think comes from SMU Continuing and Professional Education. You can give your kids or grandkids a creative and educational experience this summer at SMU in Plano. smu.edu/CAPE Summer Youth.
You're listening to Think on KERA 90.1. I'm Chris Boyd. My guest this hour is Ernest Freeburg, Distinguished Professor of Humanities in the History Department at the University of Tennessee and author of The Age of Edison, Electric Light and the Invention of Modern America. Join us at 1-800-933-5372 or send email to think@kera.org. So let's talk about the electrification of the country. Obviously, you know, big cities got this first, as big cities are wont to do with new technologies. But it took a very long time for the rural parts of the country to even be considered worthy of electrification.
Sure. I mean, one part of the story that I think is interesting is that in some ways electric light spread very, very quickly, because just about any small town could invest a modest amount in having a dynamo and a string of lights, or often a factory or a department store. Somebody, you know, it didn't cost that much to have some electric light, and so people, much earlier than we would think, moved in and out of a world of electric light. They just didn't necessarily have it in their homes, and most of the initial. I mean, I think this often happens with new technologies. It was really the businesses that pioneered they were the ones who had the deep pockets and could see some advantage in investing in these technologies, and it was only later that consumers were able to afford this. And that, of course, began in denser urban areas, spread to small towns, but for a very large portion of the population up until the 1930s, they were beyond the reach of the power lines. The technology was there to reach them, but it just didn't pay until the government got involved in the 1930s.
That was the WPA project.
REA, the Rural Electrification,
Rural Electrification
Administration.
Yeah.
That's right. Yep. And basically, Roosevelt announced that electric light was not, or access to electricity was not just a luxury, but a necessity, and put the government's resources behind encouraging the use of electric light in places and electric power where it had never been. It took about 20 years. You can certainly find lots of places around the country where that didn't actually, the lines didn't reach them until the 1950s.
We're talking a lot about light today, but electrification also sort of opened the market for all kinds of other devices. You know, as long as a house was wired, it might as well have many things that plugged into the wall.
Sure. And Edison, right from the start, recognized that that was the case, that once you got this into people's houses, light was the thing they wanted, though. That was the driver. Everybody recognized that light was a need. Once you had the wire in your house, then you might decide it was a good idea to have a toaster or an iron or so forth. But it's hard to imagine the country investing the enormous amount of energy and resources that it took to wire up for anything other than light, which everybody recognized was a tremendous breakthrough in control over nature.
How did it change the nature of family life at home together in the evenings?
Many people felt that this encouraged a new kind of individualism in the culture. People, back especially in places where there was a small centrally located lamp, people would gather together at night around the lamp, and there was, family time, and people would go to bed earlier, but they would have that social time together. Once you have electric light in your house, first of all, children can be allowed to play safely away from, you imagine how dangerous it would be to allow children to play in a room by themselves with candles and oil lamps, but electric light resolved that problem. So the family dispersed in many ways. There's also a lot of evidence there was a huge growth in personal reading in this time period, and electric light obviously had something to do with that as well. It was much easier to stay up late reading. I was struck by how many people were most excited when they got electric light. They really wanted an electric light next to their bed so that they could stay up and read. And apparently reading in bed with a candle or an oil lamp was considered about as irresponsible as we now think smoking in bed is.
Yeah.
But having an electric light in bed was this great luxury. But again, reading is a solitary activity, it encouraged a kind of dispersal, and in some ways, if we're thinking about the various ways that electric light made modern life, I think that kind of individualism is part of the story.
1-800-933-5372 is our telephone number. Let's go on the phone now to Bill in Irving. Hi, Bill.
Hello. Austin is the only city in the world that still has the moonlight towers.
Oh.
Yeah, in the late 1800s, like the 1880s, Detroit had started an extensive system. The city of Austin, I'm originally from Austin, the city of Austin purchased 31 towers from Detroit and set up moonlight lighting all over downtown Austin with arc lights. Anybody that grew up in Austin decades ago remembers these. They're still there, but the city's kind of grown around them, of course. And they were around the University of Texas, all downtown Austin, you name it.
The towers are there? Are they still using the light itself,
yeah,
or just the tower?
No, they're still using them. So originally there were 31. There's not quite that many now, but there's still, most of them are still there. There's a Wikipedia page that shows you the details of the locations. But there were 31 originally. They were arc lights, carbon arc lights. Each tower had 6 lights. They were later changed in the 20s to incandescent, in the 1930s to mercury vapor.
Wow, that's a great story, Bill. Thank you so much.
Now, those towers are fascinating, and many cities were very excited. I mean, Detroit is an example. Detroit put up 70 of those towers, and within a few years really decided it was not functioning well. So I'm sure they were happy to have Austin as a market to offload some of their towers. And in a lot of places, the towers were abandoned really within the first 3 or 4 years. I know that San Jose, California, was another early adopter of this, and they were very proud of their tower and kept it for into the 20s. And I believe they have a recreation, a smaller-scale version of that tower now. But I certainly have to take a look at Austin's tower soon. That sounds fascinating.
Did people realize right away the impact on wildlife, nocturnal wildlife?
Well, yeah, it was horrendous. You know, I guess it remains to be today. Maybe we just take it for granted now. But when those lights first came on, migratory birds especially were wiped out in huge numbers in many places across the country. And the Statue of Liberty, and there's another example. There were people who were calling for the torch on the Statue of Liberty to be extinguished because there were so many dead birds at the bottom of the statue every morning. But it's one of those tolls of electric light that we just decided to live with.
1-800-933-5372 is our telephone number. We have Hans on the line in Fort Worth. Hi, Hans.
Hi, how are you?
Great, thank you.
I just wanted to ask the author if I didn't get a chance to read the book, but I heard it on lunch. He was talking about Edison and whatnot. I didn't know if he had an opportunity to discuss about Nikola Tesla's contribution to the whole electric thing.
Yeah, I mean, I should say this. I'm interested in Edison as a figure that people identified as the personification of invention and of turning scientific ideas into practical, usable objects in the late 19th century. But Edison was certainly very quickly surpassed by people who knew a lot more about electricity than he did. And he made the wrong choice in terms of his anxieties about AC power. And Tesla clearly, knew far more about electricity than anybody else at the time, and played a very crucial role in turning this electrical system into something that could be a nationwide grid. Particularly with his partnership with Westinghouse. So yes, I mean Tesla is enormously important, and clearly the greater scientist. I do think that part of what I'm trying to get at is the idea that, in spite of the fact that Edison is in the title of the book, I'm really trying to suggest that invention is something that is a very complex social process, and it's not a handful of individuals, even somebody as talented as Edison or Tesla, but rather an entire culture that has to gear itself to embrace new technology and to adapt new technology and to make it work in the marketplace, which involves things like insurance regulations and safety regulations and, aesthetic judgments about what's appropriate.
And in fact, so, it was the insurance folks who were the first ones to say, hold on, we've got to have some standards here because we're tired of paying out fire claims.
Yes. Cities, people were being electrocuted in the streets. They didn't have much recourse. But when the buildings started to burn down, the insurance companies really were in a panic. There were a terrible rash of fires because of these arc light wires, particularly. And these wires were going up in the middle of, if you've ever seen late 19th century pictures of downtowns, where there were just an absolute forest of wires. And these were telegraph wires, burglar alarm wires, stock ticker wires. Most of those were harmless. They had a very small amount of electricity in them. But once you put up these powerful AC wires and they started to break or the other wires broke and crossed them, you had fireworks displays of sparks in the sky and a lot of fires, a lot of electrocutions. And there were no safety regulations. So it really was the insurance companies who began to impose on building owners and on the industry itself the first push to develop some kind of shared safety regulations.
Back to the phones now. We have Rollin on the line in Dallas. Hi, Rollin.
Yes, I'd like to ask the professor about the 1898 Chicago exhibition and how that contributed to the acceptance and adoption of lights in this country.
Right. In 1893, the Columbian exposition.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah.
And huge displays, right?
Right, yeah. And I was something like 90,000 lights, and these were set up by Westinghouse. It was really the first vindication that AC power was going to be the wave of the future, for one. And it also served as a chance, I think many people had seen electric light in some form or another at the circus or in a department store, but this was a chance to see a deeply, profoundly illuminated urban environment, kind of a fantasy land of electric light. But it really, for many Americans, they left there thinking they had seen a vision of what the modern 20th century city was going to look like as a sort of fairyland of electric light.
I was struck multiple times, Ernest, going through the book about the parallels between this age of Edison, as you call it, and the adoption of electric light, and the internet age, where you have sort of collaborative invention, and it really isn't one individual working alone in a lab, but lots of people with good ideas.
And yet we tend to talk about this as if this was all given to us by Steve Jobs and Bill Gates. Right? And in much the same way, I think we look at Edison and Westinghouse as people who, it's their genius that somehow delivered this to us, when in fact, you're absolutely right. I think there's sort of a wide open frontier. The digital age is going in directions that no person could have anticipated. Many, many people in many different ways have been creative. And also a similar sense of anxiety, people hungry for the new thing, but also very much aware of how disruptive it is in our lives, and that there are trade-offs. For everything that we gain, we also recognize that there are social consequences.
And another trade-off was wasted energy with the incandescent bulb, which, compact fluorescence solve that problem, although the light is not as beautiful.
Right.
Can you talk about, we're entering a new era, really.
Right. I mean, it's interesting because Edison, right from the start, Edison said this incandescent light that he was selling around the globe was a terrible waste. That coal-powered electricity was terribly wasteful way to produce electricity, and that the incandescent bulb, which takes 90% of the energy and converts it to heat rather than light, that this was very inefficient, and that there had to be a better way. And so Edison was really, in the late 19th century, part of this this push. He said that, the greatest inventor of all is going to be the person who figures out how to do something different than this, in terms of producing energy. And he was very interested in tidal power. Others were working on solar power very, very early, and wind power, and the move toward more efficient bulbs, things like the fluorescent bulbs. Tesla was an important pioneer in that field. Everybody was looking for something that was more efficient. So I think, it's surprising, in fact, how long the basic principle of the incandescent bulb has lasted, given its obvious inefficiencies.
The new book by Ernest Freeburg is called The Age of Edison, Electric Light and the Invention of Modern America. Ernest, it's been a really interesting discussion. Thank you so much for being with us.
It's been my pleasure. Thank you.
Today's show was engineered by Shelley Canavy. Joe Bellotti answers the phones. Christine McConnell produces the podcast. Jeff Whittington is our senior producer. You can learn more about the show, find out about upcoming programs, and download the podcast at kera.org/think and email comments, questions, or suggestions to think@kera.org. Once again, I'm Chris Boyd. Thanks for listening and have a great day.